Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. And for the second time in a row, we're on all Skyping in.
Which also marks the second time that we're all talking without shirts on.
Shirts? I don't have pants on, dude.
Well, I got a shirt on, but...
No pants?
That's it.
Oh, I'm wearing underwear, dude. Not a savage.
Barbarian.
That's the line from Barbarian to Civilized. Underwear.
Yeah, so I finally got to play Twilight Struggle.
What's that?
It's that Cold War board game. It's two players. One player plays the United States. The other player plays Russia or the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah. I remember you mentioning that before. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually a lot easier than I expected.
How so?
Well, it was less difficult. What do you mean, how so? I expected this level of difficulty, and it surprised me with a different, lower degree of difficulty.
And so, not in a bad way?
No, not at all. It's because as a first-time player, it allowed me to kind of like focus on how the game unfolded as opposed to learning different rules.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's pretty much, you got two main things. You've got like little chits that represent objectives, but really it'd be easier to think of them as influence.
Mm-hmm.
The game term is objective. And then you've got cards which can give you influence, or they have little events written on them, and you can choose to do either one.
Hmm.
Cool.
And yeah, that from those basic mechanics, you've got the game, and the board is a map of the world, and you just, you know, you're trying to add your influence to different countries and different regions.
So you can rule the world!
Essentially, ah. Yeah. Hmm. And it was really, really good.
Hmm.
And Kennedy won the Cold War. I was playing the Soviet Union, and did very, very poorly.
So it's a quasi-historical game.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you recognize a lot of the events on the cards, so...
Not if you didn't study history.
Ah, okay, I guess you wouldn't.
Well, you're admitting something there, Wayne.
Yes, I am.
Khrushchev, yeah.
Russia.
I think you know who Che Guevara is.
Yeah, there's a reason I stick to science fiction. Now, I was kind of curious to know how it played, even though... I don't know, it was kind of lower on my scale than other games, only because it's two-player.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Generally, two-player games are good, but I find I prefer games with more people, so.
Yeah, I guess. I'm glad there's games like that out there, though, because if you can't get together a big group, then it's really nice to have a semi-complex or a semi-deep game to play with one other person.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of the multiplayer games do... Like, they can be played with only two people, but they tend to suffer and not be as good when only with two. So,
right.
It I don't know, it's kind of like a balance. You know, two-player, you can't play with a large group, but the bigger ones kind of stink when you don't have a full table. So,
yeah, I certainly didn't feel like there was anything lacking in the strategy or anything with the Twilight Struggle. You know, with a lot of two-player games, sometimes you think, oh, how fun would it be if there was... more than one person aside, and unfortunately, I'd say it's definitely a two-player game.
Right.
So, I saw, but I didn't play. I'll be playing it next week, is X-Wing Fighter.
Yeah, I'm kind of, kind of mixed on that one, especially after I saw the price tag. So.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
Well, how much are the core sets? What, $15 or $20?
The starter is $39.99, and I think you get those...
You get three guys. So
yeah.
You get two TIE Fighters and an X-Wing Fighter.
Yeah, as well as all like the measuring templates and chits and cards and stuff. So you do get a lot. The expansion boosters are only like one ship, and I think they're about like $15, which seems pricey when you think about it, but I don't know. After further consideration, it's not all that bad for a miniatures game. It's because you do get a lot in the box, but it's just kind of the idea that you only get one unit in the box, you know?
It looked pretty cool, yeah. And I guess the big thing that they're promoting, or one of the big things they're promoting, other than the fact that it's Star Wars, is that everything is to scale.
Yeah, I think they said it's, what, like 1/270th scale or something?
Yeah, so when I was comparing like the TIE Fighters to the X-Wing Fighter, I was really surprised that the X-Wing Fighter looked so small. But then, yeah, I guess that's how it looks. So.
Even at that scale, though, because, like, looking at him, the TIE fighter, I don't know, seemed to be about as big as a Space Marine Terminator out of Warhammer 40,000. But even by that scale, if could they even do Star Destroyers and things like that?
I guess everything's possible. What it would be is it would take up your entire room.
Yeah, right?
So you wouldn't really move it.
Well, I mean, like, they do that in, Battlefleet Gothic, where they have the giant capital ships, and they also have little fighters, but they just kind of muck about with the scale. They're about the same size. You just have to imagine. But if you're saying everything is to scale, then that's got to be hard.
Yeah, because in Battlefleet Gothic, like, the ships don't actually really mean anything. Mm. To, like, score a hit on the ship, you actually have to hit the stem of the flying stand. That's where the ship is.
Yeah.
So the model is actually just kind of like a visual representation to see what's on the table. But not knowing how targeting rules work in X-Wing Fighter, maybe the size of the model actually matters, you know?
Yeah, hard to say. Because it actually had the little turning templates for them, so you could see how far and how quick you turn. And if you didn't use that, you couldn't really do scale with that kind of template, I guess.
Yeah, I think probably the Millennium Falcon will be the biggest ship you're going to see in the set.
Hmm.
And then I guess if people really wanted to do capital ships, then you could do that. And I could see people being pretty crazy about that, because there was certainly enough variation between the capital ships in the movies that, you know, you'd have some interesting models, and maybe the smallest might be, what was it, the... Carillion Corvette.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The first ship we see in Star Wars.
Yeah, that thing with, like, no shields that gets the hell blown out of it. Gee, who want to play that?
Well, it did all right. It took a couple hits from a Star Destroyer.
Mm.
Of course, they were just trying to cripple it.
I have no idea if this is the actual way the game is done, but it could be pretty interesting to use the capital ships as an environment. Because that's kind of how they displayed it in the movie. You know, when somebody flew into a Star Destroyer, really just kind of the landscape changed to this, you know, Imperial one that was shooting at you. Maybe that's kind of the terrain that you can use. That'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy. I mean, someone on the Board Game Geek forums did a table that was the Death Star trench.
Oh, sweet.
You know, I thought it looked pretty good, and I thought they were pretty clever in that they had, like, clear plastic shelves that went over the trench to allow models to essentially, you know, quote-unquote, fly over the trench but not be in it.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know if I'd want to, I don't know if I'm going to play the game, but I don't know if I would want to see, like, giant capital ships, because, like, I don't know, bigger isn't always better. Like, War Machine came out with those giant, like, I forget how big the base are, but the giant colossals, and you just look at them and you're like, that's entirely too big, you know? Like, some people are like, oh, that's awesome because it's a giant, and then other people, me, I'm just like, no, it's too big. Why? Why did you feel the need to do that? That's kind of ridiculous.
I had a buddy who was a proper modeler, and he got one of the Titans out of Warhammer 40,000. And the model, compared to the regular ones, you know, which are maybe an inch tall, this thing on the same scale was actually like 3-4 feet tall. It's
so
massive.
He got the 40K scale version of the Titan.
Yeah, yeah. Not the epic scale, but the actual 40K one. It was huge.
Like the Forge World resin model thing
that costs
like an insane amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, like, that was what he did. He had his own, little miniature museum of models and stuff, but, man, weighed a ton, too.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that was it. Well, I'll let people know how it played, for those who haven't played it. It looked pretty good. It's always nice when you have a friend who's really into buying games.
so that you don't have to. Yeah.
That's why I love you guys.
It's like you have a library of games. You can go and play them for free.
Yeah, but I'm in a werewolf mood right now, so I'm picking up some older werewolf, The Forsaken books.
Hmm. Are you going to kick into that giant Kickstarter?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe you should explain what that is.
It's the 20th anniversary. It's the 20th anniversary version of the Werewolf the Apocalypse book, and they're doing a Kickstarter of it, and kind of like what they did with Vampire the Masquerade 20th. Anniversary. It's the rules aren't really revamped from what I've seen. They're just kind of cleaned up and maybe tweaked a little bit. Like the book, the finished book sounds awesome. Like the special edition is going to be like, you know, a leatherette embossed hardback with die cut claw marks on it.
Wow.
You know, which sounds awesome, but you have to put in a pretty, in my opinion, pretty steep pledge level just to get a physical copy of the book. It's about like $120. So.
Although I like the mythology better, I can easily upgrade that on my own, and I actually really like the rule set for the the Forsaken and the Requiem. So,
yeah, I think that's what it is. Like, I could be wrong, but I think it's simply, you know, Werewolf the Apocalypse, maybe like revised edition, printed again. So,
yeah,
not the New World of Darkness.
All right, well, that's it for I guess our gaming news, and I guess we're going to talk more about gaming.
Though perhaps not news.
An excellent plan, my friend.
I had no idea what I was doing with that segue.
You know what? It showed.
So now we're doing gaming old stuff. What? Why is there this microphone in front of my face? What's going on?
Well, how about this? We're going to move on from gaming news to gaming opinion. How's that?
Oh, news and opinion, like Fox.
Yeah.
except they don't
with
have any
news. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. So what we're doing in our second episode for the month of horror is curses, and we're actually debuting something a little bit different. Is that we would like build the episode around a tool that we've come up with in how you can determine what curses you can use in your game. All right, so we got this tool for marketing, and it's called a position map. And what you do is you take two axes, and you label one axis one thing. So let's say quality, and you label the other axis another thing. Let's say price. And let's say you're talking about cars. And then you place different car models on the map and where they would be in relation to quality and price. And people in marketing do that so they can see, you know, like holes in the market where they could perhaps position their product. Hmm. So what we've decided to do is, in curses, we've chosen two axes. One is severity, like how severe the curse is, and the other is realism, how realistic the curse is.
So if you think of each axis as kind of like a gradient, like if you have the severity axis on one end would be mild and the other end would be, well, severe, because that one's pretty self-explanatory. So then on the realism axis, one end is sort of natural. So it could be something that mimics a disease or something that might not actually register as a curse, or it could just be a case of being unlucky. Whereas the other end of the axis, we decided would be like supernatural, and that's where your vampirism or your lycanthropy style curses would come in, something that's very, you know, overt and could only be caused by obviously something that's not natural.
Hey, Chris, you going to talk here?
Oh, what? Yeah.
He's thinking.
Sorry, Matrix. Yeah. I nodded off there for a minute.
So to help shape your story, we figure that you take some classic curses and you put them on this curse position map. And you look at that, and that'll help you decide what kind of curse would be best for your story. So if you had something like the Midas Touch, that's very supernatural. I mean, you know, people don't naturally turn things into gold with their touch. And that's pretty severe because it's just everything he touches, including his daughter. So that would be way in at one end of the spectrum. And then, as Wayne said, you know, if somebody was just a little bit unlucky, they're always getting a red light when they're driving around. And that's very mild and very realistic. And that's on the other end. And even as you start to put it, you might want to mimic some of these curses. Or you might see a hole where and that can help you generate your own unique curse. So what we're going to do for the rest of the episode is kind of use the tool, put it in action. I'm going to talk about curses, when to just, in general, why we would use curses in a game, and then we'll put it on our own position map, our example.
So while doing the research for this episode, one of the, I guess, kind of interesting things that I found was the definition of a curse is a wish that some form of adversity or misfortune will befall someone or something. And I kind of think that's the key point of a curse, in that it's a wish, meaning that the person who invokes the curse doesn't really do anything personally to follow through and make sure that the curse happens, you know? Like, I don't really think you could consider it a curse if, you know, you supposedly lay a curse on someone and then you actively go and hunt them down, or you actively sort of, you know, attempt to make their life miserable or enact some kind of vengeance upon them. Now, that's just kind of, as you said, vengeance. Where,
yeah, it's a kind of fire and forget weapon.
Yeah, yeah. Or fire and someone else is going to handle it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Except for voodoo dolls.
Yeah, I suppose. But even then, like, Yeah, I guess you are taking an action, but you aren't really like going out and then stabbing them with, you know, the needle, just their little effigy doll. Wow.
No, so, I agree. I mean, that is a very, very important distinction between like a curse and something that's not
vendetta.
A curse.
Vendetta. Vengeance.
Or a serial killer, you know. not really a curse, buddy.
Yeah.
But just to like to further that, I mean, it can be fire and forget. But of course, a lot of stories have it where you can get the curse lifted, and it can be by the person who originally gave you the curse.
Yes.
Or it could be that there is some sort of condition or stipulation on the curse. And if they, you know, atone for whatever, then it will be lifted.
I think that's what makes them so interesting for stories, because, you know, they are so broad, and there's so many things you can do both with the curse and having it being lifted. You know, they're, I don't know, there's just a lot of, they're, I don't know, I think they're great story hooks or motivators, you know, because, yeah, they're, hey, the person's going to want to get uncursed, so they're going to do whatever they can to make sure that, you know, that curse gets lifted from them.
Absolutely, but I think we should also make clear that it's not necessarily just one person getting cursed. I mean, you can curse like an object or a place. So there, the curse kind of can transfer from person to person. You can you can curse an office, like the presidency of the United States is apparently cursed.
Yeah, yeah. Although I heard that kind of died with Reagan and Bush, how they both kind of, you know, escaped assassination or pretzel choking attempt.
Yeah, I mean, you can escape a curse, I guess.
Hmm.
But it maybe hasn't broken the curse.
Yes, maybe he's still cursed.
Yeah, I mean, if you escape it, I mean, you've escaped it, but not necessarily broken it, and that's another distinction. Hmm. So, like, looking at the, I mean, that's the office of the presidency is cursed. It was by Tecumseh, the Native American chief. So where would you put that on the position map?
Well, in that one, did it actually say what would happen, you know, what the effect of the curse was, or is it just kind of the office is cursed?
Oh, any president that was elected on a year that is a multiple of 20 will die in office, be assassinated in office, sorry.
Hmm.
So I would put that pretty realistic. I mean, it just die.
Right.
So it could be from an assassination or things like that, like things that would naturally occur.
Hmm. Such as a bullet.
Yeah.
Yes. Naturally occurring bullet.
Yeah. In nature.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think American presidents get quite a few assassination attempts on average, so I don't think this is especially good. But, I mean, for each president that has been elected on a year that is a multiple of 20, man, that's long, there have been some kind of death or attempted assassination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I definitely agree with you, Lyle. That would be a natural curse, because it's very broad, I guess, effect. Will die in office, you know, could be from anything. But, I mean, in terms of severity, the person's going to die. So, yeah, that sounds that sounds like a natural and severe curse to me.
Yeah, I would think, like, not only is it severe because it's death, but also it's severe that it affects an entire office.
And an entire country. Like,
yeah, yeah. Well, I did mean the office of the presidency, not necessarily like
the room,
three people. Yeah. my office den.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the duration of the curse, but you're absolutely right. Yeah like
darn, we've already got our two axes. Yeah, you could put duration.
So wait, but we have an x-axis, a y-axis, perhaps duration is the z-axis. There you go. It's a three-dimensional position.
No one
map.
Can draw that, dude.
Sure you can. Haven't you ever drawn like an x with a little 45-degree angle line going through it? There you go. Whoop, whoop.
No, I just do the regular ones. I can't do the other.
Oh, come on. You can't draw
can't
that transparent
third dimension.
Cube.
No, I do them all the time. Don't you see me in the work meetings?
I do, actually. Could that be considered another form of curse? Oh, go to this meeting. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Okay, you know, so we've got, like, with the Midas touch, we've got the severe supernatural. With the presidency, we have the severe realistic.
Right.
With the red lights, you have the mild natural or realistic.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then for a mild supernatural. You could have it where, you know, we did ghosts last episode, so you could have a ghost that kind of follows you around and...
Yeah, or being haunted. Your house is haunted.
Well, yeah, it's like being haunted, but they don't really do anything.
Yeah, because it's mild.
They're just kind of annoying. I think we've seen a couple movies like that. There's one with Phoebe Cates.
Mm-hmm.
It might be called Right Said Fred. And I think it's her imaginary friend.
Oh, yeah. Why do I
Or maybe it's
movie?
Called Right Said Fred. I think maybe Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah, I think Drop Dead Right Said Fred was a band, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Were they also possibly annoying?
Maybe Right Said Fred is just like, you know, it's always in, you know, I'm too sexy. It's just like running through your mind. That would be severe natural.
Or how about this? What if I'm too sexy is just constantly playing around you that everyone else can hear? It's mildly annoying, but that's definitely supernatural.
Every time you turn the radio on, it's Right Said Fred.
Oh, yeah. Or I was just thinking, like, you have this aura of music around you, you know? Unexplainable. Supernatural, but not that bad. Or not.
Yeah, so we've got the four quadrants mapped out. And then we can have things that can kind of slide on the scale, especially severity. And this was something that we had a little bit of a debate prior to the episode of whether or not to even include it. And it was about things like vampirism or lycanthropy.
Yeah, the question is really, because the curses have obvious benefits, you know, vampirism, you are immortal. Some of the more recent additions, you are beautiful, super strong, all that good stuff. But, you know, it's also still the curse of the forever hunger and damned soul. So does it really fit into a curse or not?
Well, I think it could. And here's where, like, for example, movies or fiction can help you, like, kind of map out where your particular type of vampirism or lycanthropy or whatever, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or they turn into the Hulk. Mm-hmm. And you think like a movie like Near Dark. That would be my favorite vampire movie.
Right.
And when you watch that, you see, you know, how much of an inconvenience, or it's beyond an inconvenience, the sun killing them.
Mm.
Or the fact that they're, you know, they are immortal, which can mean that they would have to lead pretty transient lives and they're predators and that. So it really would make it look like vampirism is quite a severe curse, mm-hmm. if you will.
Well, also going with, like, the Near Dark example, like, some of the characters in that pretty much, okay, they embrace their vampirism. But because of that, they kind of don't act like humans anymore. And because of that, they always have to be on the move. They're always kind of, you know, that risk of getting caught, even though they are sort of immortal and strong and have these special powers. It's like, no, you're just not going to be human again. People are always going to be tracking you, hunting you down. That's definitely a curse in my eyes.
Yeah. Now, on the opposite end of the spectrum, so opposite it might not even fit on a positioning map, is Twilight.
Yeah, instead of the transient lifestyle, you just go to high school every year and the teachers forget about you every year.
I think they did move around, but still.
Yeah, they sunlight doesn't kill them, it just makes them sparkle. Then that's it? Is there other downside?
You're constantly hungry, or I don't even know if it's that.
Seems that you're quite emo.
Yeah, that's a curse.
Yeah. You're self-absorbed. Oh. Yeah, so you can kind of put that on your map, and then you think, well, what kind of vampirism, if you're thinking of it as a curse, what kind of vampirism do you want in your game? Or lycanthropy, I mean, whether or not they can control their change and things like that really determines whether or not lycanthropy becomes a curse. Mm-hmm. Or just something that you can spring on somebody when you're in trouble, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like we talked about earlier, like in, you know, Werewolf the Apocalypse and Werewolf the Forsaken. I'm pretty sure you retain your full, or almost your full mental, you know, faculties when you transform into a werewolf. You remember everything that happened. So in that one, it's kind of a curse because there are downsides, but it's not as much of a curse as the more, I guess, traditional or vampire or werewolf we see in folklore, where they have no memory of, you know, the time that they were a wolf, and they just kind of, you know, wake up covered in blood and don't know what's going on. That's definitely more of a severe curse.
To be fair to Werewolf the Apocalypse and Werewolf the Forsaken, they don't present werewolf lycanthropy or werewolf. Like, so they're not presenting it as a curse. They're presenting it as this is a race of people.
Right.
Or a race of werewolves.
Or something in between.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. All right.
For a really good example of lycanthropism as a curse, check out the Ravenloft Lycanthropy Supplement. It's a really ancient book. It'd probably be hard to find anywhere besides online, maybe from the Wizards PDF library. But that one is fantastic at making as a curse. They have mechanics in there for how much, I think it's red meat you must consume on a daily basis, and how it affects your soul as far as it gets eaten away and turning animalistic, and the kind, different kind of physical changes that occur when it happens to you. So some really, really good stuff about lycanthropy in that.
Oh, that kind of reminded me of the Gangrel from at least Vampire Dark Ages, where every time you frenzied, you took on one more bestial feature. So, or even in like Vampire Requiem, I think, Nosferatu, right? With your physical deformity, that's definitely more on the curse, or the more on the severe side of things. You can't hide that.
This is true.
This is true.
We also have the curse of Echoalia.
Okay, well, we mentioned the Midas touch before. Actually, those, some of the Greek mythology, those are some of my favorite curses that you see. Things like Cassandra, who can see the future, but the curse is that no one will ever believe her. Everybody knows the Midas touch, where everything he touches turns to gold, including food and his bedding. Also, Medusa, she was cursed. And Tithonus, who was cursed with immortality but not agelessness, so that he just got older and older and older and turned into a grasshopper. And the reason I like these so much is that, I guess with the exception of Medusa, they're all beneficial curses, if you know what I mean, in that it's kind of granting a gift, but the gift comes with such a horrible price that it is, in fact, a curse.
All right, sorry, my mind is just still reeling the fact that if I lived long enough, I'd turn into a grasshopper. Sorry.
No, well, I think in those, it's just like the monkey's paw, and it's like, careful what you wish for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think... A lot of times when the way curses are used in stories is that there is some sort of like moral or comeuppance involved in there. You know, you look at Beauty and the Beast, and he's cursed to look like a beast.
Yeah, that's
And that, yeah, and he can change back if he gets somebody to fall in love with inside. I think there was a new movie called Beastly.
I saw that. It's pretty bad.
I was going to say, I think if you use a curse in the game, it should be along those lines. Like, another reason that I like them is, yeah, they usually are comeuppance for something, you know? Mm-hmm. And in the case of a role-playing game, it would be the actions that the character took, you know? I think it would be kind of unfair to just sort of slap a curse on a player character for no real reason.
Yes, that would suck.
You know? I mean...
I know what you're saying, but I'm going to disagree a little bit.
Right.
I mean, there's the mummy's curse where, you know, they have a little advance warning, like those who disturb the mummy tomb, ill fortune befall them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they go, well, we'll disturb it anyway. And you're like, well, yeah, I guess, but what did they do? You know, did they really do something wrong?
Well, yeah, they disturbed the final resting place of the king. There you go. It said don't, you know? When you see a sign that says don't, no trespassing, do you complain when you get picked up by the cops?
I think you would.
Yeah.
And then the cop says, you know what? It says right there, no trespassing. You're like, oh, yeah, it does. Oh, no, I guess you're right. All right.
I know that I would be wrong, but I would still complain about it.
All right.
No, but the reason I like those ones, and the Mummy's Curse is included in this, is that it kind of offers us the carrot to the players to try and take. You know, here's something really cool that you can get, but there's a bad side to it. I mean, you think about the Mummy's Curse. Why did they go into the tomb in the first place? Probably to go after the Pharaoh's treasure. I just really like the duality of that, where it's you get something really cool that the players might want to go after, but it flips around on them.
And yeah, or the Hope Diamond, which apparently has a curse, but it's, you know, the biggest, I don't know if it still is, but it was the biggest diamond in the world.
Right.
So you're like, okay, well, you know, you want to have that and own it, but it comes at a price. And I definitely see the appeal for that.
Yeah.
But I certainly think that, you know, a little slight... You know the gypsy woman, or you know, to use a stereotype or whatever, and you inadvertently slight that person, and then they curse you with something, and it can seem unfair, and that can be frustrating. But you know, play with that.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but even that I see as something that the player did, whether they were kind of aware of it or not.
What if they're... Okay, so let's say Moses, right? And he goes to Egypt and he... to the Pharaoh and it says, let my people go, right?
Right.
Now, yeah, from our perspective, we say, well, yeah, you shouldn't have slaves. Slavery is bad, right? But
right.
Back in that time, he's like, well, no, these are like my property. These are my, not my people per se, but.
Yeah, because those were Moses' people, the whole let my people go thing.
Yeah, I got that.
Sorry, can I just interrupt here and say, I love how the past three episodes have turned into Bible time with Lyle.
Oh, we're
sorry, continue.
Sorry, we just did Greek mythology. I thought we were open to like stuff like this.
Yeah, sure we are. I just think it's funny that you're all teaching us all religiously, you know?
Anyway, so from the Pharaoh's perspective, he's not doing anything wrong. And then the Egypt gets, you know, gets a bunch of, you know, plagues, like the frogs and then the angels killing all the firstborn sons.
Mm. Yeah, it was a pretty crappy choice then.
Now, of course, when you read it in, you know, Sunday school or whatever, you're like, well, yeah, you don't mess with the chosen one, you know. But, you know, if you're Egyptian at that time, you'd be like, what did we do? We didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there are cases where, you know, somebody, you know, in Midas, he was tricked.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little unfair. In I guess, if you're Egyptian, like, why should your firstborn son die?
Mm. Well, I mean, I didn't bring this up, but you want to get real unfair. I mean, all Cassandra did was, you know, say no to having sexual intercourse with one of the gods. And supposedly Medusa... The reason she got transformed was because she got raped by Poseidon in Aphrodite's temple, where
yeah.
I'm sure that was totally her fault.
Right.
But we have to decide if it's a legitimate rape or not.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, she didn't get pregnant, so I don't know. So maybe it was actually rape, according to that Aiken guy. We probably should mention that in case anybody did not get that reference.
Right.
Yeah. Look up Todd Aiken, you'll understand.
Yeah, please Google that.
Right now. Stop the episode and go look at it.
I understand what you're saying, like, in an RPG, it's all about, you know, balance and,
right.
You know, you don't want to punish the players, but a lot of times, you know, that is an integral part of a curse is, like, it's just not fair.
Or,
you know, well, of course I didn't want to have all my food turn into gold and my daughter turn into gold.
Yeah.
You know, of course when I said I wanted to live forever, I wanted to be young and live forever. I didn't want to, like...
Yeah.
Turn into a grasshopper.
Keep aging. Yeah, it's like, what was that? Yeah. And I understand you don't want to have the player's frustration, but imagine if they did get tricked and it's kind of like a Midas thing. They're not going to like that.
Well, I mean, I suppose it depends on your group.
You said you wanted everything, and you're like, oh, I didn't mean everything.
That sounds like something that would happen in a Changeling game, because, like, the Fae, that's something they would totally do. You know, oh, well, you didn't word it exactly right, so there you go. Boom.
Yeah. I like it. If it were presented as a story hook, I can see the appeal in it, how it could be fun. But it depends on your group, whether they're willing to take that kind of thing or not.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things, like, you could kind of start the game with that being the hook, you know, the story hook. Like, now you have to go on this epic quest to, you know, find the solution, to track this person down, to have them reverse, you know, the curse or the hex on you. And, yeah, that could be fun. And, yeah, you know, certain players would be like, oh, I'm cursed. Oh, well, that's really interesting. It sucks, but it's interesting. So now let's see what happens, you know, and let's see where the story goes. But... You know, certain players would just be like, oh, so that means I'm kind of crappy at this now? Can I just roll up a new character? Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
What do you think about retconning things? And I guess it's not retconning in a sense in that you could say, well, we never really knew the true origin of that sword. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But like let's say for two adventures, this sword is just a great magical sword. And then you're like, well, I want to do something different and shake things up, so I'm going to curse it now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always cursed, but you never noticed it. It was kind of like building or something.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think as long as you don't tell the players that you're doing that, it's a fantastic idea.
I think even if you tell them after the fact, you know, it's fine. So, again, so long as you don't kind of, I don't know, it would have to be something really gradual, in my opinion, where the player would eventually notice, hey, something's going on with this. You know, like, I guess a good example is, you know, the ring from Lord of the Rings, you know. it kind of slowly got more and more sinister, and people eventually kind of figured out, hey, this thing isn't that great. And, you know, I'm not saying that J.R.R. Tolkien, well, actually he did. I mean, in The Hobbit, who knows if the ring was going to be evil or not when he wrote that, and maybe he decided afterwards. I don't know. But if he just all of a sudden decide, oh, and that sword always gives you a -5, and you're just like, oh, come on. You know, I've had this for, you know, 3 adventures now, and now it's a cursed item. So that would be pretty cheesy.
Yeah, I think you're right that the gradual thing is good. In addition, maybe it allows you to build in an escape clause for it. You know, maybe as they use it, next time somebody does a detect evil spell or something along those lines, you know, they get an inclination that there's something up with this sword. Or, you know, the person has a momentary flash or something whenever he draws the sword. Just kind of foreshadow what's coming so that they have a chance to look into it if they're interested, or maybe just ditch the thing if they're
Yeah, interested. I was thinking that too. You know, the gradual clause
I like
gives
the
them a way
the
out.
Foreshadowing, yeah. But obviously, they are going to notice at some point that it's cursed, so there's no point in having the curse.
Right.
It's like, after the adventure, like, oh, by the way, you were, like, really cursed. You know, it's like, really? What? Oh, yeah, I was, like, taking -1 on all your rolls. And you're like, well, that's not really worth having.
Well, it could be one of those things where, and I this would be different for different games, but it still has a benefit, you know? Maybe the curse, like we said, isn't apparent right from the beginning, and it's not something overtly so mechanical. You know, it's just, wow, that's a really good sword. But, hey, everyone I interact with in town distrusts me for some reason. You know, they might not, or the player might not eventually make that link, you know? And it's something they might put up with for a while before they actually realize, if they even do realize that it's because of that cursed sword.
And you never know. The players might even turn it around and enjoy the curse. I remember a campaign we played where a guy had a -1 or -2 sword. But his 2-hit bonus was plenty high enough that he didn't mind the -1 and the -2. In fact, because it was a cursed sword, he couldn't get rid of it. So he just threw it at enemies and then it would come back to him. So it was his own, like, returning weapon for a while.
That's actually pretty funny.
But I mean, hey, I think that's something to encourage in the players. If they can find a way to turn the curse to their advantage, then more power to them.
And that's when the DM just ratchets it up even more.
Cool. All right. Well, so we talked a little bit about when to use the curse and whether or not, you know, the player should know, and should it be a punishment or should there be some more moral. But, I mean, what are some different types of curses? I mean, if we look at the realism axis, what kind of things could fall on that one? Like, what kind of things would we consider, like, a natural curse? I was thinking, you see the Stephen King Thinner, and he keeps getting thinner. And there's a lot of wasting diseases, and a lot of curses, like, just mimic diseases.
Right.
Or the curse could be getting a disease, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, and I like that option because lots of game systems already have rules and mechanics for poisons and toxins and diseases. And so you as the game master wouldn't have to invent, you know, a whole slew of mechanics. You could just say, you know, pick one, sort of reskin it, and that's the curse, and your mechanics are already built for you.
Yeah, as far as using pre-made things like that, too, hindrances work really well as sources for curses, or rather, effects of curses, rather.
Yeah, like if the game has, yeah, as you said, hindrances or flaws or, you know, sort of negative qualities. Yeah,
exactly.
I think applying one of those as a curse would be pretty good.
Just generalized bad luck, and that fits into kind of the natural and, I suppose, more mild end of the Matrix.
Well, you're kind of bringing up luck, Chris. The one, or one of the other things I kind of thought of for the episode was, you're going to love this, Lyle. It's the anti-Benny. You know? And I could see that as kind of like a resource management mechanic for, you know, the GM. Instead of a player being able to spend that to re-roll dice or to be able to kind of, you know, add to a die roll, I could see the GM coming up with some kind of mechanic where, you kind of have a certain number of these bad luck tokens, and I'm going to decide when they get spent, and, you know, it's going to subtract from your die roll, or you're going to have to re-roll that again. So, I don't know, I think that could work.
No offense, man, but I would hate that as a player. I'd hate to, like, roll a success, and then the DM look at me, and here's my chip.
Yeah, well, then you shouldn't have gotten cursed.
I guess so. Yeah, sure. No, I don't want to say those are bad ideas.
But they're bad ideas. Go on. You know you want to say it.
No, because I think that's a perfectly viable option. I just, and I think a lot of people really get excited about mechanics. I just am not one of those people. So with bad luck, because we are using die, and you have unlucky die and or unlucky dice and things like that. So I get it, but I would prefer to have them be unlucky in like things that happen in the story.
Right.
Wayne, I mean, you always bring up a great example when you're watching Gossip Girl now. Oh, busted. And,
yeah, I'll cop to that. I'm in the middle of season 3 right now. I'm loving it. So.
And I'm loving it. And I was watching something the other day. I forget what it was, but it was Mean Girls.
Oh, because it got so much better than Gossip Girl.
She kisses the guy, and then Lindsay Lohan looks, and they happen to be kissing, and he tries to push her away after Lindsay Lohan looks the other way.
Right.
You know, just stuff like that happens in movies and stories to, as you say, Wayne, to propel the story forward. And I think things with things like unlucky curses or whatever, I think you could just do stuff like that.
Right.
You know, they'll do things, and someone will see them do it.
Yeah, the wrong person will see them do it.
Yeah, the wrong person will see them do it. They'll go to somebody's house at the wrong time. The person that they thought wasn't going to be there is there because they left their keys or something like that.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much everybody they talk to is in a bad mood.
Yeah,
they say something and you can just suddenly drop in that, it was the absolute wrong thing to say.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, like the person's mother died, recently.
And they made it, and you made it your mama joke, so.
Yeah, something like.
Yeah.
That is bad luck.
No, I definitely like those. I think maybe the reason I went to mechanical things first personally is because to me that just makes an interesting story and kind of how to separate just having an interesting story from actually giving bad luck to the person is much more nebulous and gray, when you use sort of narrative-only things where it's also a little bit harder to judge the severity of that bad luck where, if you do something more mechanical, it's a little bit more concrete or a little bit more differentiated from just being kind of things that drive the story forward. But I certainly don't disagree that that is a good way to show bad luck.
Yeah, there is the idea also of fairness. I mean, to come up with story ideas that display their bad luck can seem arbitrary, and some players might rebel against that, whereas if it's a specific numbers thing, then it's more like a rule of the game. But again, that depends largely on your group. And I think that the story idea is probably the more fun way of going about it, but maybe just a word
of
caution.
Definitely. I agree. It's more fun, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, that is one thing that does mystify us when we look at the D&D Next debates and people are going on about how much control the game master, the dungeon master should have. And I think the three of us are kind of on, as much control as the dungeon master wants to have,
right.
It's fine by us because we don't get into situations where the dungeon master or game master ever abuses that position.
Right.
It's always done to further the story, and there is that trust there. But yeah, I guess if you're in a group where you don't have the trust, and there are bad DMs and GMs out there.
Hmm. Yeah, what?
You do need some constraints.
I'll just throw it out there and say that if you're playing in a group where you don't trust the DM, you probably shouldn't use curses in the game because they're just going to screw you over.
Or maybe not in a fun way either. Or maybe not even play in that group.
That's the next step. I was trying to tie it,
to
the episode and not just be general advice. But okay, broad strokes, stop playing with them.
Yes.
Let my players.
But I guess if that's all they have to play with, then what can you do?
What's better, no game or a really bad game? There you go.
Ooh, wow, you're getting all philosophical.
Is it better to have roleplayed and lost than never to have roleplayed at all?
Yeah, I guess at least you tried it. I know that was a rhetorical question.
Yes, in fact, it is.
And I guess another thing in favor of the mechanics is that it's also very easy to put on your position map. You can gauge the severity because, this would be -5 and that would be -1. So that's quite easy to put on your thing.
Well, I guess you brought this up at the beginning, and I hadn't really thought of it, but as you said, the duration. right? The duration could also be an easy way to judge the severity of a narrative-focused curse. You know, how long is that person going to react negatively to you? How long is that person going to hold a grudge for that, you know, poorly timed your mama joke? Or how long is the person going to spread rumors about you because they saw you with the wrong person at exactly the wrong time? You know, if it's a relatively short time, well, then the curse isn't going to be that severe. If it lasts, you know, for a while, well, then more severe. So I think that could be a way to do it too. Or how many other people it affects, you know? How far does that gossip spread about that thing that you allegedly did, you know? If it stays to like a, you know, a tight circle of people, well, then it's not that bad. If you go to another city and somehow somebody still knows about that and you're affected by it, well, then, yeah, that's pretty severe. So maybe scope and time duration are ways to judge that as well.
Yeah, good point, Wayne. So, you know, you mentioned about how, like, the more mild and natural side of the curses is something like a disease, or where it might be difficult to distinguish it from just a case of bad luck for it. In your groups, would there ever be a situation where you wouldn't tell the players that they're cursed and maybe let them try and figure it out on their own?
Yeah, sorry. When I meant realistic, I don't necessarily mean that the person doesn't notice that they are cursed. Going back to Thinner, I mean, I think it's a Native American kind of touches his face and says something like along the lines of Thinner. So he's able to kind of connect. He has that clue.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think if there is a curse at some point, it should be pretty central to the story. I mean, it's pretty rare. I can't think of any example off the top of my head or anything that I encountered when we were investigating it, maybe because we were like Googling curses. But
yeah, I was using Wikipedia.
Yeah, it seems pretty central to the story that there is the curse.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that they would kind of know about it.
No, that's a very good point, because you know, it's kind of the mantra we have on the show. If you put something in there, make sure that it's worthwhile. You know, don't do it crappily.
Yeah,
our mantra keeps changing.
I know. I thought the mantra was, if you're going to make it matter, make it matter.
Yeah, but then we realized that was kind of a truism. It was like, if you're going to include it, make it matter. I think that was our original mantra.
Yeah, well,
that we,
hey, I like tautology. It's all
yeah,
good.
Well, yeah, that we have forgotten.
But no, it's I think that probably the weakest way to put curses in is kind of the old D&D method, you know, where you find a sword and it's -2. There's so much more that you can do with it that you absolutely make it part of the story.
Yeah. No, I think that's pretty much what I was going to say. You know, like, it's one of those things, like, if it's everywhere, then it ceases to be special. Right, like if everybody in the campaign world is able to sort of, you know, create or undo or curse people, well, then big deal. Everybody can do it. So what?
Right.
But if it's, you know, if it's something big to the story and, wow, this has never happened before, yeah, then as Lyle said, the story is going to revolve around it because it's that important.
Yeah. All right, well, that wraps up curses. So what we would do is, you know, just an idea for a tool that you as a game master could use is to do a position map. And we may or may not try to do a position map and post that on the forums to show an example of what we would do with it and how we would use that position map to come up with our own, hopefully interesting curse.
Perhaps I'll try and whip up a 3D one to prove Lyle wrong.
Yeah, good. Good luck there. Promises, promises.
He thinks in two dimensions.
We didn't do very much with cursed places in that. That's something we would like to revisit in a future episode. So we decided to save that. Oh, what a teaser.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Well, check us out online at www.idlerdhands.com, idlerdhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there online or download it off of DriveThruRPG, listen to it through Stitcher or stream through iTunes. You can also send us an email from the website, or you can post comments on the episodes, reach us on our forums, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter and tell us about your curse.
Perhaps it's tongue-tiedness.
All right. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.